Welcome back to the program. As Republican candidates prance around the country trying to define their conservative credentials, it's worth noting, as perhaps they should, that this year marks the 60th anniversary of the publication of the then 26-year-old William F. Buckley's God and Man at Yale, a book that many consider one of the seminal texts of the conservative movement. It was a book that would redefine conservatism in the Cold War era and beyond, a conservatism that had pretty much evolved from Edmund Burke and the French Revolution and was for all intents and purposes near death. Buckley would go on to found the National Review, provide the intellectual heft to continue to drive conservatism, provide the ideological underpinnings of Barry Goldwater, run for mayor of New York, write 50 books, appear in almost 1,500 episodes of Firing Line, and all the while define the difference between the passion of ideas and the importance of friendship. We're going to spend some time today talking about William F. Buckley with my guest, Carl T. Bogus. He's a professor of law at Roger Williams University. His previous books include Why Lawsuits Are Good for America. It is my pleasure to welcome Carl Bogus here to talk about Buckley, William F. Buckley, Jr., and the rise of American conservatism. Carl Bogus, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Great to have you here. It's important to note, I think, that at the time Buckley came along after and wrote God and Man at Yale and began to redefine conservatism, that the conservative movement, as it had evolved from Edmund Burke and Oakeshott and others, was really near death at that point.
That's true. Conservatism was pretty much given up for dead. The last three Republican nominees for president, Dewey, Wilkie, and Eisenhower, had come from the liberal wing of the Republican Party. And many observers thought that conservatism was over and didn't have a significant tradition, and it was a relic of the past.
And when Buckley came along, there were really a couple of key principles that were the core of his ideas, which he articulated in God and Man at Yale, which was, one, that economics wasn't conservative enough, that kind of Keynesian economics of the time was kind of leftist or collectivist, as he saw it, and that Christianity wasn't being taken into account appropriately.
That's correct. He was 26 when he wrote God and Man at Yale. He was a recently minted Yale grad, and he wrote this book, which was an attack on his alma mater. And it was an analysis of the economics department and the religion department. And Buckley thought that the economics department was not indoctrinating students in a pure laissez-faire ideology, which he thought was right and true and good. And he also said that although the religion department was academically everything one could wish for, that it was not proselytizing Christianity. And Buckley argued that the role of a university was actually to indoctrinate students. It was God and Man at Yale attacks the idea of academic freedom. And in perhaps his two most important sentences in that book, he wrote, "I myself believe that the duel between Christianity and atheism is the most important in the world. I further believe that the struggle between individualism and collectivism is the same struggle reproduced on another level." And so what he was saying is there's an existential struggle for the world going on between good and evil, between Christianity and atheism, and of course everybody knew that he also meant between the West and atheist communism. And he collapses that belief with this idea that the good, the true, the light is also being fought out in economics, and that what he called individualism, at God Man at Yale, he didn't call himself a conservative, he called himself an individualist. And what he meant was this pure laissez-faire ideology is part of the struggle for the world, and it's on the side of good. It's not a debate, a technical debate, about economics. It's this existential struggle for the world.
But mixed in with this individualism was this streak of libertarianism, which is part of conservatism still today. How did Buckley reconcile that libertarian streak with these ideas, with the sort of anti-academic freedom belief?
Well, that's a great question. Bill Buckley was a man of contradictions and paradoxes. And he was a very evocative writer, but he wasn't a political philosopher, never really laid claim to being a political philosopher. And many of his ideas are really inconsistent, and there is an inconsistency between his libertarianism, which is people should be free to do what they want. Yale should be free to do what they want. And his religious conservatism, which said there are these moral precepts in this struggle for the world. He was a bit of a Christian crusader, really. And there's a lot of inconsistency there. He did not resolve the inconsistencies. He embraced them. And it was because he was what we today call a libertarian, a neoconservative, and a religious conservative. Because he was able to be all three himself, the conservative movement became a blend of those three ideologies.
And it's interesting to see the way that pieces of that would play out in the political arena. Both first with Barry Goldwater, who leaned towards, and particularly as Goldwater got older, leaned towards the far more libertarian side, and the way that Reagan tried to square the circle as well.
That's absolutely correct, Jeff. Goldwater was a libertarian and a neoconservative, but absolutely not a social or religious conservative. And Reagan attempted to kind of, as you say, square the circle, especially in his speeches and rhetoric. He laid claim to being all three things. But Reagan was also a very pragmatic politician, and many of his what are considered his greatest successes were done despite the opposition of Bill Buckley and conservatives, particularly his negotiation of arms control treaties with Gorbachev.
It's also interesting, I mean, even within the pages of National Review, which Buckley founded in 1955, they were all of these strains that were represented by so many of the people that were writing for the magazine, people like Brent Pozell and Hayek and Gary Wills and Russell Kirk, all of whom represented different branches, different aspects of this kind of new conservatism.
That's right. And one of the things that made Buckley such an extraordinary leader was he never considered it all about him. He opened the pages of his magazine to people who had a diversity of views. He claimed it was a place where conservatism was being debated and refashioned. He allowed a pretty wide span of views to be expressed and debated, pretty wide, but not completely wide. There were limits he set, and he purged writers who went beyond what he considered the boundaries of acceptable conservative debate.
And within that, one of the things that's particularly interesting is the people that were attacked by the magazine. I mean, they were not believers in Ayn Rand. They were very anti the John Birch Society and even opposed people like George Wallace.
Yes, all of that is correct. The magazine, of course, you mentioned Ayn Rand, and I think one of the more significant aspects is that the magazine did do its best to excommunicate Ayn Rand from the conservative movement. Now, Rand never considered herself a conservative. She said she was not a conservative. She had her own philosophy, objectivism. But she was certainly a libertarian, and has despite National Review's attempts to excommunicate her, has remained an important figure in libertarianism, and particularly bringing young people who find her novels compelling into the conservative movement.
When one looks back at so much of the writing in National Review during this period and the state of conservatism, one of the things that's quite remarkable, I think, is to realize how embedded it was in the Cold War thinking of the time, that so much of it was tied to the struggle against the Soviet Union and the Cold War, that in retrospect it's hard to sort of tease out conservatism as a movement and as a set of ideas from the Cold War.
Yes, that was certainly the defining issue of the time as National Review saw it. And National Review advocated a more aggressive approach than the consensus Republican Democratic approach of containment. So all of the presidents throughout the period, whether they were Democrats like Kennedy and Johnson, or Republicans like Eisenhower and Nixon and Ford, believed in this containment principle, that the idea was to contain the spread of communism. And National Review advocated a rollback strategy, which was that containment was not enough, and the West should risk even nuclear confrontation with the Soviet Union to attempt to roll back the boundaries of communism. So that was the defining issue as National Review saw it. Of course, there were other important issues of the day, but it was the America's and the West's approach to communism that overshadowed everything else.
Even the religious aspect, I mean, going back to God and Man at Yale, even the religious aspect was defining, you know, Christianity's struggle against not just atheism, but kind of godless communism, as Buckley saw it at the time.
Yes, the thing that was at the core of all of this was that everything got collapsed into one issue, one ball of wax, where all of mixing metaphors, or a ball of yarn, where all of the strings are intertwined. And as those two sentences in God and Man at Yale first laid out, Buckley and National Review saw all of this as one struggle, the struggle against communism and economic policy, social policy. It saw it all as one interrelated theme.
Which is why it's so interesting and difficult in some respects to look at this philosophy in the context of the post-Cold War era. And the one idea, and you talk about it in Buckley, the one idea that sort of transcends that is this kind of view of liberty that conservatives had.
Yes. I think that the principal dividing line between liberals and conservatives are that conservatives have what political philosopher Isaiah Berlin called a negative view of liberty. Now, he didn't mean that as a critical or pejorative term by calling it negative, but what he meant was conservatives believe that liberty is not being coerced by anyone, particularly the state, but by anyone, into doing things you don't want to do. That's what liberty is, and he called it this negative view of liberty, which is basically leave me alone. And that liberals believe in what Berlin called the positive view of liberty, which is that real liberty requires some resources in order to make it possible for people to have a reasonable potential to pursue their desires and to make of their life what they want. Standards or bases in education and health care, wholesome communities, and that this was the dividing line between conservatives and liberals. And I the more I've studied this, the more I think that Berlin was onto something, that this is one of the real dividing lines between conservatives and liberals.
And with Buckley, a lot of it seemed to come out of his Catholicism. Talk about that.
Yes, it was. Maybe not a lot of it came out of his Catholicism. It may be even accurate to say all of it came out of his Catholicism. So Buckley's family was a deeply religious, devout, traditional Catholic family. You know, there are different Catholic traditions, and there's the liberal social justice tradition, and there is the more Catholic authoritarian tradition. Honor tradition and honor the authority figures of the church. And Buckley's family came out of the latter. And his father was a very devout Catholic who spent his formative years in Mexico during the Mexican Revolution, when the church was an ally of the old authoritarian regime and was being attacked by the revolutionaries, Zapata and Pancho Villa, etc. And William F. Buckley Sr., Bill Buckley's father, I think during this period developed and his own ideological view, his own worldview, where he thought that the church and religion was an essential component of order, stability, good government, virtue, and truth. And Bill really inherited his father's worldview.
Mm-hmm. Of all of the writers that Buckley had assembled at National Review, and it really was and became kind of the conservative farm team, who was closest to Buckley's particular views? Who did he look up to in terms of intellectual heft among those writers, do you think?
That's a great question. The person he was, I think, closest to personally was James Burnham, who was the de facto number two at the magazine. Now, Buckley never made him the official number two at the magazine, because the magazine was a collection of prima donnas, and that itself would have upset many other people at the magazine. But James Burnham was really the man that Buckley was closest to, and in many ways respected the most. Burnham was the foreign policy guru at the magazine, and the architect of this rollback principle. But it would go too far to say that he respected Burnham in all respects. Burnham, rather paradoxically, was in many other ways a rather moderate conservative, mm-hmm. and he kept arguing that the magazine ought to endorse Nelson Rockefeller for president, the leader of the liberal wing of the Republican Party, something that was anathema to everybody else at the magazine. The other person that Buckley was particularly close to was Frank Mayer, who was sort of the in-house libertarian. Now, Buckley himself was a libertarian and a neoconservative, but Mayer was the libertarian thinker who wrote a variety of libertarian books and articles. And Buckley, I think, respected him the most when it came to overall political philosophy.
You talk about, you know, the views of Rockefeller and the liberal wing of the Republican Party. I mean, it was really anti that wing, which was the reason Buckley really ran for mayor in 65.
That's exactly right. So in 1965, Barry Goldwater had been defeated and humiliated the year before in the presidential race. It was the right wing of the party had captured the party temporarily and nominated its candidate Goldwater with national reviews applauding the choice. Goldwater went down to a terrible defeat, and the conventional wisdom was that there had been a resurgent right wing, but it had flamed out quickly. And one of the rising stars in the liberal wing of the Republican Party was John Lindsay, who had been a congressman and resigned his seat to run for mayor of New York. And Lindsay not only was a part of the liberal wing, but had refused to endorse Goldwater, something that Buckley and the conservatives considered to be political treason. So Buckley ran on the conservative party ticket as mayor in the mayor race in order to drain Republican votes away from Lindsay so that Lindsay would not win the election, and this rising liberal Republican star would be brought down. Ironically, the analysts tell us that, in fact, Buckley wound up draining more votes from the Democratic candidate and actually helped contribute to Lindsay's victory.
Talk a little bit about Buckley as a candidate, because it really reflects Buckley as an individual, as kind of a conservative happy warrior, that Buckley had a persona that was so, in many ways, antithetical to what we see conservatism as today.
Right. Well, we can start with his first press conference when he announced he's going to run for mayor on the Conservative Party ticket. And he is asked, why do you want to be mayor? And he says, I've never considered it. And the journalists furrow their brows. How do you have somebody running for mayor and claim that they've never considered why they want to be mayor? And they ask him, "Well, do you think you have a chance to win?" And he says, "No." And they ask him, "Well, conservatively speaking, how many votes do you expect to get?" And he says, conservatively speaking, one. And they ask him, well, what would you do if you win? And he says, demand a recount. Now, the Conservative Party officials who were standing there at this press conference watching their candidate handle his first press conference are aghast. You don't have a candidate who comes out of the gate saying, I have no chance of winning. However, Buckley was right and they were wrong. This totally refreshing approach of honesty and charm and wit was galvanizing. And people became, particularly young people, became enthralled in Buckley and Buckley's campaign. And Buckley made it clear in that press conference that he was running to advocate conservative ideas, that this was a campaign about ideas. And he had an enormous impact, not just in New York, but nationally, in attracting attention to the then still embryonic conservative movement and conservative ideas. And many, many people, particularly young people, became conservatives because they were so charmed by Buckley. They wanted to follow him. They wanted to be part of his army. Many of them wanted to emulate him.
And it's interesting that there was that core group of young people that Buckley activated that would be sort of anti the culture wars that would start to emerge post-65.
Well, some of them are anti the culture wars, and some of them were probably happy culture happy culture warriors. And that was Buckley's uniqueness, was that he embraced these inconsistent ideas, religious conservatism and libertarianism, for example, and was therefore able to fashion a movement that had a coalition of these three groups.
What did Buckley himself think of the culture wars that emerged in the late 60s?
I think he was of mixed mind about it. In certain instances, I think that his sentiments ran that way, particularly when it touched on religious issues like abortion. In other issues, he slowly moved towards the more libertarian position, particularly in regulation of drugs. So I think that was something that the tensions, he felt those internally to some extent, and in many ways he dealt with it by not making those the centerpieces of his own writing and advocacy.
And of course, one of the things that came out of that, and one of the criticisms of National Review at the time, was its positions on an attitude towards the civil rights movement. Talk about that.
Well, that's a bleak and unhappy history in National Review. National Review was quite adamantly against the civil rights movement. So was Buckley, particularly in the early years. And right up to the point of arguing that, quote, the marginal Negro, by which they meant the Negro that will make the difference in an election, should not be permitted to vote. Really standing against blacks voting in the South and arguing that they weren't ready to vote, they weren't sufficiently educated, maybe even suggesting that it might possibly be a genetic issue and not just an educational issue. It was, a dark period in National Review's history, something that many conservative historians attempt either to ignore or deny, but the civil rights issue is not something that I think National Review is proud of.
Did Buckley ever actively regret it?
Yes, he did. In later years, when asked what his great regrets were, he listed that first as his greatest regret. Although I have to say also that he never wrote a large mea culpa. Uh-huh. If you look at his books and his articles, even in the late in life, he mentions this as his big era, but he doesn't dwell much upon it.
One of the unique things for Buckley that you write about in the book is that for him the political wasn't necessarily personal, and that he was even close friends with many of the liberal writers and thinkers of the time, people like Murray Kempton and John Kenneth Galbraith and even George McGovern and Al Lowenstein.
That's right, Jeff. And I think it's very important because Buckley was known particularly as a debater of slashing rapier style. He could skewer his opponents. He took great delight in that. When asked, for example, why Robert Kennedy never accepted an invitation to appear on Buckley's television show, Firing Line, Buckley said, well, why does Baloney reject the grinder? But Buckley, for all of his aggressive debating style, knew the line of goodwill. And he leavened his attacks with humor, and he didn't make it personal. And there are, I think, many conservatives today, particularly on right-wing talk radio, who are self-professed Buckley fans, who say that Buckley was one of the most important people in their lives, that they look up to him. They clearly attempt to emulate him. But they don't have that sense of where the line is. And the fact that Buckley could be good friends with liberals like John Kenneth Galbraith and the others you mentioned, I think is a very important factor. And maybe one of the greatest lessons that he taught us, which is you can believe in something passionately, fervently, and yet not come to reject people who disagree with you.
Gore Vidal being maybe the only exception for Buckley.
Well, he's not the only exception. He's the most infamous exception because of their fight that they had on national television where Buckley threatened to punch Gore Vidal out on live national TV. But there were exceptions. It wasn't that Buckley loved all liberals nor all conservatives, but he certainly did count among his dearest friends many ideological opponents.
When did he come to think of Ronald Reagan?
He had mixed views about Reagan. On the whole, his views of Reagan were immensely positive. Like many individuals, he found Reagan a bit of a puzzle in terms of Reagan's enormous skills and also some of his deficits. But on the whole, he liked Reagan. He respected Reagan in many ways, and it's really important to mention that Reagan gave Buckley and National Review a large share of the credit of converting Reagan from a liberal FDR New Deal Democrat into a conservative.
What do you think Buckley would think of the conservative movement today?
Well, I'm always a little hesitant to deal with the question, what would Buckley think of something today? Buckley had his own ideas, and his ideas often surprised others. But he did befriend people like Rush Limbaugh, for example, who I think represent a kind of conservatism in terms of style, anyway, that Buckley was not a mean-spirited style. So it's rather hard for me to say what he would have thought. His views moderated somewhat in later life.
Right.
A large portion of my book is how he fought with the Burkeans, that had a more moderate view of conservatism, and prevailed against them in terms of which direction the conservative movement would go. But in later life, drifted a little bit more towards that end of the conservative spectrum.
Carl Bogus, his book is Buckley, William F. Buckley Jr. and the Rise of American Conservatism. Carl, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Jeff. I enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.